Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Experience the unconventional.
Hello.
The unpredictable.
Don't you think that's a bit weird?
And the completely unorthodox.
It was my birthday.
With rule-free Ian Lee.
I was just trying to generate a bit of content.
The late night alternative with Ian Lee.
Hate alarm clock. Hate going to work.
On Talk Radio.
Here we go. Some show tonight, guys. I can feel it. I feel it in my water, and by water, it means urine. I know I've touched it. Wiggled on my hands. I could literally feel it. 03444991000. There we go, you see. 03444991000 is the telephone number. We've got Will Storr coming in whenever he turns up. I mean, you know, he said he was going to be about 10:15, so he's still got 10 minutes to be on time. But, I mean, dear God, 10:15? What a weird time to agree. And you mark my words, when he comes in, he's going to get a right royal rollicking, Catherine. Late night alternative, Ian Lee.
Catherine Boyle.
It's doing harmony.
Catherine,
you do the same.
What
you
doing?
You do the melody and I'll do the harmony.
What's the melody, though?
Just your name.
Catherine.
Say it normally.
All right. Catherine?
No, you're saying it like a dick. Just say Catherine Boyle.
Catherine Boyle.
Say it now.
Catherine.
You're doing the thing. It's going all rugger. Just say your name.
Catherine
Boyle. Say it.
Catherine Boyle.
There you go, that's it.
What the hell was that?
It was a failed attempt to start a vocal duo group in the style of Dollar. That's what it was. And the thing is, in this, I am the lady who I think was called Toulouse-Lautrec, and you're David Van Day. Therese Bazaar, that was it.
I thought it was Pamela Bazaar.
Therese Bazaar. Wasn't Therese, wasn't Pamela, wasn't Toulouse. It was Therese Bazaar. Here we go. Oh, that reminds me, actually. I've got to do some work at my home tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I've got to raise the bar. Dr. Ray's Bazaar. It doesn't work. I thought it was Buzz. Bah. There's that Buzz. Okay, fine. So, busy show this evening, dear listener. 0344 499 1000. What this show has needed for a long time, a really long time, is a campaign. Campaigns get you press. We're desperate to get press. It's season 4 of the Late Night Alternative. We've got another 12 months of this. And the way to get press, we've done press before, by eating a pig's vagina, by falling down a well, by faking being attacked by an owl, and by saving a man's life.
Can I just say I didn't do any of those things, especially not the vagina part.
Okay. But now the step rule 5 is we need a campaign. We need a campaign. And here's the campaign we're going for. Forget kids who are dying. Forget old people that are dying. Forget anything to do with health, because that's just mucky. It's just a quagmire. What we need, and I'm going to tell you this before you go downstairs to get our guest, who I believe has arrived.
Uh-huh.
What we need is a campaign, and the campaign is this. We are bringing back, when you get off the bus, shouting up to the front,
"Thank you, driver."
Thanks, driver. We're bringing that back. That's the campaign. Now, it's a tough one. It's a real tough one. I do it all the time to the embarrassment of my kids. I don't think I've ever been on a bus with my kids. But what we need is audio and video clips of you, dear listener, using buses. And as you get off, thanks, drive.
Thanks, drive.
So you can say
casual.
That. Yeah. Thanks, drive. Thank you, driver. Whatever, we need to bring this back. Are you with me or are you again me? Tom, Dick, and indeed Abdul. 03444991000. Will Storr is in the building, Catherine. Can I send you on a mercy dash?
Yeah. When do we start getting cross with him? Once he's sitting down?
Oh,
or can I do it up the stairs?
No.
gonna be like lion, the lion's den. You bring him up all nice and friendly. As soon as he comes in, I'm gonna rip him a new one. I don't know what you're typing, Amy, because I can't see it. Oh, he's up here. He can't hear us, can he? Oh shoot!
Can I, like, when he gets in the doorway? Good, can I like boot him in with my foot?
No, when he comes in,
get in.
We're gonna rip this guy a new a-hole, because I mean 10-15. He's a very...
I mean, who does he think he is?
He thinks he's some fancy, swanky writer. As soon as he comes in, can he hear us now? OK, fine, then you shouldn't have let him in, Amy, so we can hear the plan. When he comes in, we're going to give him a... He's there! Oh, God, look, I thought it was my reflection because of the... Will, come in! Come in. We're going to tear him a new one. We're going to tear him a new one. This is going to be awkward for you, dear listener. You might want to switch off. I'm going to destroy him. Here he comes. Come in, Will.
Here he comes.
Great to see
you,
buddy.
Hello, mate. How you doing?
How you doing?
Good
you
to right? see you. Yes, yes.
Good to see you again. How are you doing, Kathy?
Sit down.
Now, what's going on? I can hear nothing. Planning and
skiing. No, nothing.
Oh, no.
Catherine, here's the thing. I'm going to tell you what was going on there. Get nice and close to that microphone because they're cheap. Catherine thought it was rude that you've decided to come in at this time of night. And I said, Will is a very busy man. Will is busy. He's got a new book out, The Science of Storytelling.
Wow.
He was a very important do today, probably to do with books and art and stuff, I'm guessing. And he can come in whenever, whatever time he wants. And she was like, oh, when he comes in, we'll shout at him and we'll tell him he's rude.
You said you're going to karate chop him in the windpipe.
No, that is libelous. That is a lie. Wouldn't do that to Will. I'm a big fan of his work.
Yeah, Ian, you're forgetting that I did email and say, I can be there at 9:55, but I'm doing something. Is it okay? And he went, yeah, of course. He said, you can come in whenever you want,
okay.
Mate. And now I'm getting grief. Are we on air?
Exactly.
I'm getting grief on air.
What happened, but it was the tone of the email that I found disrespectful to you. Tell you what, you got a coat on. Take a coat off. Would you like a drink, Will?
Oh, is this me getting the drink?
I'll go get it if you want. I don't mind going to get him a drink.
I'd have some water, thank you.
Bit tense. You might want to come back another night, Will.
You can have a hot one if you like.
No, thank you.
All right.
A little bit tense tonight, Will. Maybe you won't be selling any copies of your book tonight.
Oh, well.
Let's take a break while Will Storm gets himself comfortable. 03444991000. This is Talk Radio.
Jacked up jive talk for janitors, jazz cats and gin-soaked boys and girls.
Is that Commando?
If you're awake, you're a welcome.
I've got 5 cactus needles stuck in my...
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We're on the radio now, so you say, no, if you carry on talking if you want, but if you're about to reveal...
No, I'm not.
...intimate secrets...
No. So Ian and I were just talking about my wonderful wife, who is a magazine editor.
Yeah.
And because she's a few years younger than me, and we've both been working our way up through the media... I've always been a few steps ahead of her, but that kind of switched around maybe 5 or 6 years ago when she got her first editorship. And I really quickly noticed the difference that makes, because we were invited to drinks with some people in media who hadn't seen for quite a while. And we turned up and I was completely ignored.
Wow, okay, yeah.
For the first time, all the attention was on this amazing magazine editor. And I actually found it quite funny. It was a really interesting experience.
I would find it funny. I would find it interesting, but I've been thinking a lot about ego recently, and ego is something you can't really control. How did your ego react to it? Was there a bit of a the feeling? Here's the thing, my ex-wife, she used to hate it, and she's a reporter, she's a really, really good reporter, but people would come up to me and they would come up to us and they would talk to me,
yeah,
because I'd been on the, you know, I was a familiar face on the telly or radio, and would just completely ignore her or go, could you just take a picture of us, please? You know, a hand of a phone and stuff. And that's what she, to a certain extent, was perceived as. I know that she hated it, understandably so. You know, she found it really... And she would quite often just go off and walk away and let us get on with it. How did you find that kind of shift in focus?
Well, I mean, not too bad. So... The reason that why it wasn't too bad is because I see us as playing slightly different games.
Yep.
She's an editor, I'm a writer, and these are related but different things.
Yeah.
And we had a situation last year where Farah wrote a brilliant book called The Discomfort Zone, and suddenly she was playing my game.
Right.
And I did wonder, if Farah's book becomes a massive bestseller, how will I cope with that?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, you know, I'd love to say... Oh, I was just supportive and proud of my wonderful wife.
No, that's
and it's not a gender thing. It's just purely an ego thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
of course.
I genuinely think I would have found it difficult. And at one point she said to me, you know, if my book really does well, you're not going to be jealous, are you? And I said to her, and I thought for a moment, and I said to her, I can't promise you that.
No, because that's beyond your rational, yes. loving, logistical control.
Yeah, and it was a slightly awkward moment that I felt bad about. But
luckily,
at the same
it was a huge flop. So you're going on Amazon leaving one-star reviews under different lockers.
It really was. No, it's done really well. So, but yeah. So, so that was the learning for me. So yeah. I don't want to sort of make out that I'm this sort of big man. Oh yes, I'm fine with her soaring celebrity. But I don't see us as competing, and I think that's the difference.
It's like A Star Is Born, but in the literary world. That wasn't a cough to indicate anything. I actually literally had to clear my throat then. That was a genuine, I'm clearing my throat, but it was like A Star Is Born, one of our favourite films, Catherine.
I hated that film.
Yes, I did too. Yes.
It's so boring.
It's boo. What else was everyone seeing? Because they loved it, didn't they?
Well, and I thought there was this moment in the car park where she was singing this song that was supposed to be, oh my God, she's a genius. And she's just shouting.
But that's what I do with my kids when I go, I think I've got a song, guys. Here we go, I love you so much, my baby. But
it was like the worst Simon Cowell audition.
But isn't it funny, after one listen, he managed to arrange and write the rest of the song ready for it to be performed.
Yeah.
To her surprise.
Yeah. I have come to the conclusion, and I think I heard Limmy. I don't know if you're aware you are of Limmy.
I love Limmy.
Isn't he great?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I heard him express it first, and I've been thinking about it a lot. I've come to the conclusion that I don't like stuff that everyone else likes. Not in any way just to be difficult or obtuse. It's just, I just don't like it. Star Is Born was getting 4 and 5 star reviews, and I thought it was awful. The Ricky Gervais programme, Afterlife, which everyone has raved about, you like it a little bit better than
right.
me.
I thought it was all right.
I just watched it. I watched the first 15 minutes and went, this isn't speaking to me. There's so much stuff that everyone else is liking, and I'm going, I don't get it. I don't understand what it is. So maybe I'm just genetically predisposed to not like stuff. Maybe I'll get some miserable old git.
A contrarian.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree with you with it. I mean, I sort of departed from Ricky Gervais actually quite early during Extras. It was Extras. Yeah. I was a big fan of The Office.
Of course.
Are you a fan of The Office?
I love The Office.
So it's not everything.
Yeah.
But I saw For Work. I had to see his film. It wasn't The Office. It was the David Brent film.
Oh, my God. I went to the premiere of that.
Did you?
It's the law of diminishing returns with him. It's all going down there.
Yeah. And I you wonder who... Who was the talent behind... You might know, Ian. Who was the talent behind The Office?
It would appear that since he split up with Stephen Merchant, Stephen Merchant seems to be going, I didn't see the film that Merchant did with The Rock, but that got quite good reviews, the recent film he did. It would seem that Merchant is, you know... But hey, Gervais is getting paid $11 billion a year from Netflix.
As he keeps reminding us.
He does. You've got a book.
Yes.
Did you bring it?
No, but you've got one there.
I've got it. The Science of Storytelling, Will Storr. And bless you, I was away last week with my boys in the country. We rented a cabin. It was, I make it sound more rustic than it was. It was a luxurious cabin with a hot tub on some kind of cabin resort. We were just having the best time. My 7-year-old has got this line now, which he came up with. They got in the hot tub every single day and every single night. And I found some plastic champagne flutes in there, and I poured orange juice in. And then I got in the hot tub, and my 7-year-old turned around to me and went, "More champagne, beautiful." And that line has stuck now. That's now his catchphrase every time he sees me, because he goes, "More champagne, beautiful." And he's totally made it up himself. But last week I got your lovely email saying, "I've got a new book out." In that very British way, when you get Americans emailing, "I got a new book out, where should I send it to you? When can I come on?"
Yeah.
Which I kind of respect the emails. But a lovely email saying, I've got a new book, I don't know if you'd be interested in having a look. I went, "Dude, I love you. Of course I would love to read it. And when do you want to come on?"
I was very flattered. Thank you.
We're big fans of yours, Will. But I haven't read it.
No, of course, you've only just got it like 2 days ago, so yeah.
So The Science of Storytelling, and well, you tell us what it is.
Well, I'm trying to kind of tackle the kind of ancient problem of how to tell a story, but from a scientific kind of perspective. So by using kind of the latest things that we know from psychology and neuroscience and evolutionary psychology, you know, how our minds have evolved to kind of show in a hopefully relatively new way how stories work.
And you, this, I have read a little bit of it. This, because people will recognise you. You've been on the show before. You did the Will Store versus the Supernatural, which is just a great read. And I you know, I don't want to take money out of your pocket. You can probably get it for a penny on Amazon.
At the most. Yeah, you can get three for one.
Yeah, honestly, it's such a good book. There's Heretics we had you in. The last one was Selfie. Was that the last one?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I'm missing one. I'm missing one, aren't I?
There was the novel.
Okay, right.
Everyone misses the novel.
Okay. but you, in the introduction to The Science of Storytelling, the new one, you talk about how when you were writing the novel, you were reading loads of how to write a book.
Yeah, so I was researching The Heretics, and The Heretics, as you know, is about the psychology of belief. And the question that The Heretics asks is, why do clever people end up believing crazy things?
Yeah.
So it's not like, why do idiots believe, because that's obvious. It's like, you know, how does David Irving, who was once this very well-respected historian, not a stupid man, come to believe that Hitler was a friend of the Jews? Like, insane idea.
Oh, The Heretic. That's when you went on that. This is such a great book as well. It was Heretics, wasn't it? Where you went on an Irving
walkabout. I went undercover
around Auschwitz or something.
It was a holiday for 7 days. Yeah, around Holocaust sites with Irving and a bunch of... he's quite litigious. Yeah, but no, they were
Well stopped.
I remember this one because he's explaining the gas chambers to you that they're not gas chambers. Obviously they could get out, so what?
Yeah, he was sort of joking there. He was pointing out, there's the box office. It was a joke. But they were genuine.
I wouldn't open with that one, David, but yeah.
There were genuine Nazis there. There was a guy who had a tattoo of some sort of Panzer division on his... body somewhere.
Wow.
So there were genuine Holocaust deniers there with him. I'm not saying that he is one.
No, of course.
But he certainly was one at one point. I think we can say that. But there were lots of Holocaust deniers there. And I was trying to blend in with him for a week. So that was part of The Heretics. And to understand, how is it that these people and David Irving himself come to believe these insane things? And one of the really interesting things that I found was that a lot of these people on that trip had parents that were literally Nazis in the Second World War.
Wow.
So their mums or dads, probably dads, were Nazis, were actual Nazis. And so on the last night of this trip with David Irving, there was this a celebratory viewing of Downfall, the film. No, it wasn't really celebratory, but it was like, you know, it was like
was
a gala.
Sad. They're all crying at the end.
A gala viewing of Downfall, which of course is the fantastic German film about the last days in the bunker.
Yeah.
And one of the guys on the trip excused himself because his father was there and he found it too upsetting.
Oh God, they actually were crying.
Yeah. And but seriously, so the thing I thought was really interesting was that these were and the kind of knotty thing, the thing about storytelling that kind of fascinates me is this is very simplistic. The brain is a storyteller, and stories in novels, films, cartoons, fairy tales mimic what the brain does to us all the time.
Yeah.
The mind, the self, is a story, and it's a simplistic story. And the simplistic story about these people, where they were just all horrible Nazis, awful, awful, awful. And of course, they weren't all wonderful, but some of these guys were really, really nice to me.
Yeah, of course.
So at the beginning of the trip, I was going to say shot my load. I don't want to use that phrase, but I was interviewing David Irving.
This is escalating, isn't it?
And it became obvious that I wasn't necessarily on his side, and he kind of stomped off. And I was panicking because I spent all this money on this trip and I needed to get more out of him. And he promised he would sit down with me later, but he kept putting it off. And I was confiding in the Nazis, saying, oh, I'm really worried because David Irving promised me time, he's not giving it to me. And then at the end of every day, we'd have this meeting, and there would be like a lecture, and there'd be lots of questions afterwards. And it turned out that all the Nazis had conspired behind my back to ask questions of David Irving that they thought would be useful
to
my book project.
Isn't
and it was
nice?
Like such a nice thing. It was really nice thing.
But that's the thing is we think of Nazis as evil, and it's an evil ideology, but of course, you know, they feed their pets and they love their mums. You know, of course there is niceness around that denying the Holocaust and hating Jews. You know, I'm not making light of it, but there is that niceness.
Well, the idea that came out of that was that not all of them, of course, but a lot of them, it seemed to me, were on this lifelong mission to defend the reputation of their parents who they loved.
Right, right.
So the thing that comes first is, I love my dad. Mm. I love my mum. But the rest of the world is telling me Nazis are synonym for evil. So it can't be true. Mm. So you go on this lifelong mission looking for evidence everywhere that it's not true. And of course, that's how you become a Holocaust denier, because you find all this, in inverted commas, evidence that it's a whatever.
When I was away last week, my light reading was a book written by Mae West, one of the daughters of Fred and Rose West.
Oh.
Really good book. Came out last year. It's called With Love from Mum. And I get confused with the family tree. I think she was possibly the fourth child, because Fred had a couple of daughters before. There was Charmaine, and there was Anne-Marie, and then there was Heather, who was the one they murdered, and I think May came forth. And it's not really about Fred West. It's about her relationship with Rose West, and for the daughter's relationship with Rose West. And for a lot of it, for most of the book, even when she's Rose West is in prison and has been found guilty, May still can't believe.
Wow.
That her mum, even though her mum used to beat her,
yeah,
even though her mum knew that their dad sexually abused them and would kind of laugh it off, even though the mum would lock them in a, you know, did terrible, terrible things.
Yeah.
She still can't quite believe, despite all the, she does towards the end, spoiler alert, but for most, she still can't quite believe that her mum was capable of murdering her sister,
yeah,
was involved in the murders of the nine other women, was involved. She can't buy into that, because that's her mum.
Yeah.
And she goes, I can believe it. My daddy was weird and he abused us, but I cannot get my head around. And part of it was that when Fred was arrested, such a good book, when Fred was arrested, one of the daughters and the son and Rose were put in a safe house where they were being bugged, but they were locked in this safe house for a long time. And Rose West was kind of brainwashing them, just going, I can't believe your effing dad has got me in this effing trouble again. I can't believe he's done this. I didn't know when. And so she was just getting constantly on a loop. And she still struggles to accept her mum did all of those.
I just find that fascinating things, because that's exactly what I was seeing in these people on this Holocaust thing. They were essentially decent people who have made a mistake.
Yeah.
And the mistake is rooted in their love for their parents, just like this daughter of Rose West who... and this is really what the science of storytelling is about. It's about these characters that we meet in story who are absolutely convinced of a thing. The story is there to kind of shake them out of that kind of misbelief. And as you know from the stuff in The Heretics, when we talk about how the story manifests in the brain, sort of hard to explain, but the reality is that we experience is a story. It's we see evidence everywhere that backs up our biases and misbeliefs and prejudices. So it's so hard to think your way out of the story that your brain's telling you. It really is possible that your most deeply held beliefs about the world are completely wrong, but it doesn't feel like they're wrong because they form the structure of the reality as you experience it in your head.
Is it Heretics or Selfie? I get the two slightly confused. Where the everything we see happened like a second ago,
Heretics.
Yeah. So the brain is constantly filling in the blanks and making up a narrative.
Yeah.
So what you see is very narrow, and the rest is made up.
They call it a controlled hallucination. So we feel like we're looking out of our heads.
Yeah.
Into the world, but we're not. If you think about it,
I always get uncomfortable when you talk about this because my eye—I don't know where to look. Go on.
Information only comes in, and that's one way.
Yeah.
So it comes into your brain, and that's where it stays. So you're not looking out at anything. Everything that you experience is out there. Is actually in there.
Yeah.
So, and it takes some time for all that information to travel from your senses into the brain, and the brain to convert that into this controlled hallucination of reality. And so in order to help us interact with the now, it has to throw us forward. I mean, there are kind of variations in the predictions of how much that forward is. But if you're throwing a ball, if someone throws a ball at you, your brain moves it fractionally forward so you can catch it. Otherwise, you'd miss it.
And so that's kind of an example of I don't want, you know, I keep going on about The Heretics. It is a great book, by the way, dear listener. I thoroughly recommend it. But the brain is a storytelling machine.
Yeah.
It's constantly telling stories. Yeah. And you say in the bit of the book I have read, it's not actually the scenario or so much what happens. It's the characters that interest us. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So if you read most books on storytelling, they tell you how to tell a story in the form of a structure.
Yeah.
So what people have done before is they've taken all the great stories and they've compared them together and they've kind of run their divining rods over them and seen what they've got in common. And then they've gone, okay, well, this is the perfect story. Like the Joseph Campbell monomyth is the most famous one. And they go, this is a story. And so the only way to describe the perfect story is by describing a kind of sequence of events. Mm. So you've got this kind of recipe solution for storytelling, which is kind of what we're surrounded by in Hollywood, in long-form TV, in lots of commercial fiction. It's this kind of recipe for storytelling. Mm. But if you start with the mind and the brain, you start off somewhere else, and that's with a character, because of course mind and brain is about personality and who we are. Mm. And for me, that's a much more interesting kind of idea about storytelling. And so what emerges from that is that, yes, all this stuff tends to happen in story, and some often in a certain sequence, but the most simple form of that is crisis, struggle, resolution, the classic kind of three acts. But what's really going on under the hood, as it were, is that at the beginning, it's really about character. It's about who we are. So humans are a weird kind of ape. Like, we're not like an ape. We actually are an ape.
Yeah.
But we're weird because we're hypersocial. And so there's a very famous psychologist called Jonathan Haidt, who's also an author. And he says that we're so social, we're part B. So we really are unbelievably collaborative and social. And that's how we've dominated the earth, is by working together in groups. And that's why we're so kind of groupish.
Well, that's why I voted Brexit. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah. So that's our environment. So dogs live in a world of smell.
Yeah.
Knife fish live in a world of electricity. Moles live in a world of touch. But humans live in a world of other minds. We're constantly worrying, thinking, talking about other minds, because that's how we have to that's the realm we have to understand in order to get what we want out of life, which is to survive and reproduce. And so that's what story is. So just like a dog, I walk my dogs every day. They spend all their time sniffing stuff, and I'm like, why are you sniffing all that? It's so boring. But it's not boring to them, because they live in a world of smells. The smell is infinitely interesting to them, and story is infinitely interesting to us, because it's about minds, it's about other people. So what story is always asking of its characters is, who is this person?
Yeah,
who is this person really? You know, I see you've got the Frank Sidebottom t-shirt on, and I saw the documentary last week.
Isn't it brilliant?
Absolutely brilliant.
It's so good.
And I'm not a fan of Frank Sidebottom. No. I know you are, no offence, but I thought it was an amazing film, because he was a fascinating character.
Yes.
Who is this person?
Yeah.
And the film worked, because it was a brilliant deep exploration of this really fascinating man, and it's fascinating. And so that's what stories are. They are, you take these kind of flawed characters who do weird things, and the plot puts them under a lot of pressure, and the job of the plot really is to put huge pressure on, to force them to kind of show who they really are. So if you think about some of your kind of famous scenes in fiction or movies, some of the most dramatic scenes we have are when people are feeling under immense pressure and they're forced to choose, am I going to be this person or am I going to be this person? Mm. And that to me is the kind of essence of drama.
Well, a lot of the hero stories, the Star Wars, it's where someone is, you know, their intent is pure, but they're not very skillful or haven't quite got that killing thing. And they go off and they are tried and tested and put through all kinds of ridiculous tortures and things. And then they come out, you know, from the boy to the man.
But that's the classic story, isn't it? You can look back to the Greek myths for things like that.
Yeah,
and what it says to man is, you are better than you realise, and actually, you are amazing, and then there is hope in life.
But you have to go through hardship to reach your full potential. You can train and you can think about it, but you've actually got to suffer to a certain extent to come out the other side. You mentioned as well about the... so much money is made in stories, books and movies primarily, and video games as well, actually, you mentioned. But so much of them, so many movies now, are these really crap... They're done by corporation. It's, you know, and having worked in TV a while ago, it's very rarely is it one person's vision of, I've got this idea and this is what I want to do. There are a few examples, and those are normally the best things. We talk about The Office. The Office was two people's vision, and... I know that Steve and Ricky, they managed to bat off every bit of input that the BBC made. And they said, we're going to do this, but only if you let us do it our way.
Yeah.
And so there's hardly any input from the producers.
But there's great characters in The Office.
Yes.
Really good, genuine, three-dimensional characters, which you don't find, as far as I'm concerned, in some of Ricky Gervais's later
where
work.
You suspect that other people have kind of got involved. And this is it. So many movies, so many of the big movies, you know that it's been through a writer, then it's been through a director, then it's been through five producers, then it's been through the commissioning editor, then it's been through a head of a studio. It's just filtered away, and it's almost like an adventure by numbers. You know, you'd follow these you've got to hit these specific points. You know,
yeah, that's how it works. And yeah, absolutely right. And there's a good reason for that. I was just sort of talking. The thing I was at tonight was actually a storytelling course by other people. John York, the brilliant author of Into the Woods, so kind of the kind of godfather of all this stuff, and Tim Lott, the novelist, and Tim Lott was making the point early this evening that film costs a huge amount of money to make, so there's investors want to know, they want some kind of science involved, or some kind of like, so are we hitting all the story beats? And I think that's why it becomes so formulaic, because there's a lot of money at stake, and it doesn't cost much money to publish a book. So there's less risk involved. So
let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We're talking to Will Saw. The book is The Science of Storytelling. I shall do links and what have you on Twitter in a minute. 0344 499 1000. This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Talk Radio. We'll get you talking.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Excuse me.
Oh, Dad.
Hello, I'm Martin Kellner.
And I'm his daughter, Ruthie.
We do a podcast. It's called Ruthie, Me and My Dad.
In which I tell him how he's wrong about most things.
And I explain to her who the Bee Gees were. It's on Acast and Apple Podcasts.
And all your favourite podcast providers.
It's a unique generation gap conversation between a baby boomer dad
and his Generation Z daughter.
That's Ruthie, Me and My Dad. Brand new episodes every Thursday.
Tales of Mystery. An imagination on the radio show that does things differently.
Dolly Parton, I listen to a record that they love.
The Late Night Alternative with Ian Lee.
I'm a nutjob, but not that kind of nutjob.
On Talk Radio.
Honest to God, it's the new Breaking Bad.
Oh, no.
We've got Will Storr, who's got a new book, The Science of Storytelling. I did a tweet earlier on, and I wasn't thinking, I called it The Art of Storytelling, and someone kind of pulled me up before you saw it. You didn't even know about it, and now I've told you.
Idiot.
Balls.
Idiot.
Absolute idiot. Why did you write this? Because this your usual stuff is going out with people on the fringes of society, whether it be ghost hunters or whoever, and finding out what makes them tick or how they fit in. So why have you written kind of an instruction manual for telling stories?
Yeah, well, because it became a bit of an obsession after The Heretics, this idea of the brain as a storyteller. It changed the way I saw myself. It changed the way I saw everybody else in my life. It changed the way I wrote, and then I carried on the exploration in Selfie, talking about how we're a cultural self too. And then I started teaching other writers how to you know, to storytelling. So I wanted to kind of close that chapter in my career and go, this is what I've learned about the brain as a storyteller before I moved on. I mean, and initially, because I wrote that novel, and the novel was kind of trying to work out how does storytelling work? And you know, I think I was partially successful, but I wanted to write the storytelling book that I wish I'd had when I was writing my novel.
You mentioned at the start that you read a few when you were writing the novel. Were they any good? I've never read one. Are they any good?
They are. There's lots of useful ones. I'd especially recommend John York's Into the Woods, Christopher Booker's The Seven Basic Plots, if anybody's interested.
Because I've always imagined that the writers just go, I've got a book. I'm in me and I'm going to write, and they just sit down and they write it and they pour it out, and it's a little edited a little bit.
That's what they say. I don't think it's true that often.
Really?
I think they secretly have all the books. So what interested me in the idea was that I was struggling with my novel, reading all these books whilst working on Heretics and interviewing some of the world's best neuroscientists and psychologists, and what they were saying about how the brain processes our sense of self were the same things as what the storytelling people were saying about how you tell stories. And I was like, oh my God, they're saying the same thing. So I thought it might be interesting to put them together, which is kind of what I did in The Heretics, but this is the kind of...
I've just opened it.
compressed time. Story time is compressed time. And it is, isn't it? Because, I mean, films are not 90 minutes anymore. I don't know when they started becoming 2.5 hours long. That's ridiculous. Tell a story in 90 minutes, please. But it is, isn't it? It's a book, you know, a good book, you can read it in a couple of days if you sit down. But it can cover 100 years.
That's right. Gandhi's 3 hours, but you still feel like you've seen all of his life.
Yeah.
Like it feels real, and that's part of what the brain's doing when it's kind of producing this story of us. It's radically simplifying reality. That's part of the job. Like, we're surrounded by chaos and chaotic information and contrary information, and it turns the narrative of our lives into this very simplistic kind of cause and effect journey. It populates it with heroes and villains. It gives us a kind of a quest to go on. And if we're psychologically healthy, that's what's going on. We are kind of experiencing our lives as this David and Goliath journey, which is very, very fictional. And sort of what the book sort of goes into is, I think, some of the problems that this leads us to in real life. So when we come across people who don't see the world as we do, rather than going, oh, that's interesting, that's odd how they have these different beliefs to us, they become villains.
Yeah.
And we start to hate them and disparage them and other them and call them evil and nasty. And we see so much of that at the moment. And it's just people's storytelling brains working overtime.
Well, I mean, the obvious example of that, of course, is we don't say his name too often on this show, but people like Tommy Robinson and the hatred directed towards Muslims because they look different, but also their God is a different colour, and so you're saying that's kind of part of the normal mental process, is if people are significantly different or we can perceive them, it's what happens every time in economic hardship. It's not your fault because you're a white middle class guy. It's not your fault. Okay? It's not my fault. It's their fault because they look a little bit different.
Well, to a certain kind of person.
Yes.
Because underneath all of this, we're tribal animals. We're the main tribal animals. So one of the things that binds us together in our tribes is that we share a story of the world, a simplistic narrative of the world.
Yeah.
And like a story in a movie, like a story in a book, a story is this kind of sequence of causes and effects. So we look out into the world at the stuff that's happening, and we construct this simplistic narrative of cause and effect. So in terms of hardship, a certain kind of person, a really right-wing person in that kind of tribe, will look out into the world and see whether it's Muslims or whether it's Mexicans in kind of Trump's America, and this is the cause and effect. This is the cause that's having this negative effect on my people. But of course, that's not everyone. People on the left will go, well, they'll have a different narrative of cause and effect.
There's a brilliant paragraph. I've literally read the first two chapters. I'm sorry. But the beginning, we beetle away happily into our minutes, hours and days with the fact of the void, the fact we're all going to die, hovering over us. To look directly into it and respond with an entirely rational descent into despair is to be diagnosed with a mental health condition. You're right, we're all going to die, and you could die on the way home tonight. Yeah. Hopefully, you've got another 35, 40 years. But you're going to die. And you're going to die, Catherine. I'm going to die, but... we all kind of just carry on,
but that's
almost
part of
ignoring
that.
That's
part of the reason that the brain tells this heroic story,
right,
this optimistic story of the world, because it gets us out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
So there's an idea in psychology, they call it depressive realism. Also, when they test depressed people's instincts about life and about their own kind of chances for success in the world and kind of the nature of reality, they find that depressed people are more in touch with reality than happy people.
Right, yeah.
So to a certain extent, happiness itself is a delusion.
Yeah.
There's one of these studies, I think I write about it in The Science of Storytelling, where they got people who work in a restaurant to write out all the kind of positive things that might happen for them, and also the positive things that might happen for the people that they work with that they liked, and there were far more things for them than the people around them. We know we're all, if we're not suffering from clinical depression or something like that, you know, we're all kind of being deluded by this optimistic story that says that we are this amazing David on this journey to make our life and our lives and the world around us is going to become better and better and better. And sadly, it's not true.
But your next holiday makes you feel like a superstar. You go for it.
But the great thing about the storytelling brain is that even when we're hit with failure, we feel terrible for a while, but we pick ourselves up, don't we?
It's going to lead to better things.
The next time.
Well, this is my new thing that I've really grasped onto, is that this, everything we're doing now, your book, this radio show, everything, we are literally just filling time until we die. This show until 1 o'clock is to hopefully make you feel a little bit better as you edge ever closer towards your inevitable death. That's going to happen. Yeah. How do you teach a writing class? I just, when you mentioned it, I have an image of like loads of adults sat at desks and you kind of walking up and down, looking over their shoulders, going, yeah, very good. Well, I would change that. How do you do that? I'm sure it's not like that.
It's a bit like that.
Is it?
No. So I when I first started doing the course, it was basically me talking for like 4.5 hours. And by the end of it, everybody wanted to kill themselves. Like that happy, delusional thing had just exploded. And they just, so I had to work out a new thing. So it's kind of broken down into 10 little mini talks.
Right.
And they're broken up with like video clips. We look at things like everything from Citizen Kane, Walter White, Breaking Bad.
When the teacher wheels in the VHS.
Exactly. Everyone loves it. Everyone's like, "Oh God, thank God!" You know. So, I do like a week long course, and for that, I've
edited. Comes to those? Is it novelists? Is it journalists, or is it everybody?
It's a lot of novelists. It's some screenwriters,
right.
It's often people who are kind of middle aged who've just decided, right, the time has come.
Okay.
I'm going to follow my dreams, and write a novel, and I want to know how it works. But it's people at all levels in the kind of spectrum. I had a great message from the brilliant Charlie Higson the other day. Who's no storytelling slouch, who was very happy with the book and said it was one of the few useful ones he'd read. So that was really
brilliant.
Great. So I think what I'm sort of really happy about is that I feel like it's offering something genuinely new by. Yeah. This scientific approach and psychological approach.
I just reminded, we had a caller from the States.
Yeah.
I can't remember where he was from. A guy who, you talk about people in middle age, you know, going, I'm going to write the book. And years ago, it used to be called vanity publishing, didn't it? Where you would go and get 1,000 copies of your book printed. And now, it's incredible because you go to a website like Unbound or there's loads of others and that will print on demand, you know. So you write a book and if you sell 10 copies, they'll print 10 copies. And it's actually kind of lovely and they look like, in inverted commas, real books. But we had a guy from America. Mm-hmm. Was it him or his wife that phoned up first? I can't remember.
His wife spoke first and then she passed the phone.
Who'd written a book and he really wanted to publicise it. So he was just looking online for like radio stations and he saw Talk Radio UK. Yeah. It's like, wow, okay. So I think he emailed us or something and it popped up on the screen saying, I've written a book, would love to. So we just phoned him up straight away. This guy, and it was, you know, I paid.
I can't remember what it was about.
I've got it on my computer somewhere. I paid the $8 for the download. It's not a great book, but.
But he made something.
He made something. And then his wife phoned up again, didn't she, about a month ago, saying he's nearly finished his second novel. I don't suppose you'd be interested. Get him on. He's from Texas or something. He's got a very broad Texan accent selling his book. Good for him.
Yeah, good. Well, he's David fighting the Goliath.
Yes.
He's, I'm going to be a novelist and I'm going to get all these knockbacks, but it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's human ingenuity, that's human progress, that's what's built the civilized world, so you can't knock it.
Well, you can knock it. Because I blame 50 Shades of Grey, because wasn't that a self-published book first?
Well, I actually write about that in terms of storytelling, so I thought it was really interesting. So there was a data analyst and a publisher that got together a couple of years ago and they built this algorithm I don't know how it works, but you basically feed a book into the computer. I'm imagining that somebody's shoveling pages into a slot, but I don't think that's how it works, and it can predict a New York Times bestseller with an accuracy of 83%, I think it is. So it's a pretty good thing. I don't know what the thing. And they analysed 50 Shades of Grey, because it's the big mystery in publishing. How the hell did this book end up becoming successful? And it had this really weird plot shape. They plotted it on a graph and it's just these regular ups and downs, which you don't often see in story.
Well, that's the bedroom scene, isn't it? And
they weren't regular.
But then they also did the same thing with that. What was that other book that came out of nowhere and sold millions? It had Tom Hanks in the film, The Da Vinci Code.
Da Vinci Code.
And it had almost exactly the same plot shape. So there's something. There's some weird alchemy that both Dan Brown and
E.L. Wistie,
E.L. James,
had both perhaps by chance hit upon where so, so I talk about that in the book.
Wasn't it 50 Shades of Grey? Wasn't it a Twilight fan fiction?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. She thought, oh, I'm not done here. Let me write it for myself. And yeah, so she's happened upon this thing that's turned out to be a massive money spinner and a range of terrible films.
yes. And presumably it's outsold. Is it outsold Twilight? I don't know.
Have you? I don't want to show off, Will, but have you ever had any erotic fan fiction written about you?
Oh, are you joking? Of course I haven't.
Well, if you're lucky, I might toss some off.
Oh, I see.
I've got quite a bit of erotic fan fiction.
Can we have some? Can we read it out? It's late.
Catherine, do you want to find?
I had a look last week, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, because you think it's.
I think it's hilarious.
You think it's.
Can't
funny.
Say it out loud.
Well,
though,
one of them, right? So one, there's a few, but mainly since The Jungle, and there was a few, and then one young lady messaged me on Twitter and said, "Oh, thanks for reading out my fiction." I went, "Oh, okay. You know, we thought it was a lot of fun. Thanks so much." And then I clicked on her bio, 15 years old. So that was the end.
Ooh,
yeah,
ooh.
I know. Wow. Wowzers. So have you got it?
Yeah.
Listen, now Will, this is proper.
I can't read this out. You've got to read it.
I'm excited.
Oh, where are we? Hey. No, so, hang on.
Yeah, no, this is...
Is this me?
No.
Oh, no, so this is Grace. Grace. Hey, I smile, skipping down the little slope beside the red throne where Stanley Johnson is sat. What are we all chatting about then? So this is in the jungle.
Oh, right, yeah.
Looking at my side, I sit down on the log with Ian on my immediate left, Amir on Ian's left and Jenny to my right. Just about how Ian is a great guy, Amir starts off. Amir must be around 30, but Ian a little younger. Thank you. Dark brown hair coating over a face with lit up eyes. Ooh, charismatic, charming and good-looking.
Good-looking.
That's later.
You're jumping forwards. Yeah.
Ian's spoiler, a hit though. With the ladies in camp for sure. Especially after eating those strawberries, Amir says. I let out a breath, feeling my stomach drop, as the arise of this incident again is going to inevitably result in drama. The whole camp... Let me get to the rude bit.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute. It's quite
boring.
It's
not really rude, this one. It's kind of the promise of a kiss and a date. I mean, she's 15, so just as well.
Stop trying to entrap me for crying out loud.
Yeah, let's get
here
a couple
goes.
One.
I want some... Cheers, I think, lifting my head up and grabbing Ian's, letting him pull me up from the floor.
Can I just say, this is great the way Will's come in to promote me, but we've made it all about me. This is wonderful. This is what it should be. This is show business. Right, listen, the book is The Science of Storytelling by Will Storr. I will, and you're at W Storr on Twitter. STORR.
Yeah.
I'll tweet a link during the news if people want to go and check this out. Have you got ideas percolating for the next thing?
Yes.
Have you left those kind of investigative books behind?
No, I'm going to go back there.
Okay.
So, for the next book. So my next book is going to be about status. It's all about status.
Okay.
And about how important status is to our sense of well-being.
Yeah.
So I don't know quite what I'm going to do yet, but one of the things I really want to do is to... go and find a community where they believe they're living without any hierarchy and status, and see what that's like. Because my idea is, I bet they're not. I bet there are leaders.
So you think that it will always appear
exactly.
that someone has to take control.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
you never get anything done. Will you?
Yeah.
I'm sure the first one that springs to mind is the Amish, but I'm guessing they must have leaders.
Of course they have.
Of course they do. They might pretend that. Because to me, that the biggest experiment in that was communism, and that's George Orwell.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a crazy idea that there's no status.
You want to find a load of off-grid hippies.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what
they'll be off-grid, though. You won't be able to find them. You can't just go
can't
just
email,
go on
can't
Facebook.
Tweet them.
So how do you do it? Do you... Just you're out walking. I get my best ideas when I'm out walking.
Yeah.
I don't have a dog anymore, but when I go back home with the boys and I go out for a walk with the dog, that's kind of when Kath will be bombarded with texts going, right, I've got this idea and this idea. Is that how you do it, or do you sit at a computer?
No, that's exactly right. Yeah, so I walk my dogs twice a day.
Right.
And I have my phone and Google Keep. And
Google Keep?
It's a great app, and it's just notes, and it syncs with everything.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Automatically, and you can talk to it. So I'm walking. I'm walking the dogs, talking to my phone, going.
This is future man we've got in here. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's free. And everyone obviously who lives near me thinks I'm this lunatic who goes around just talking out loud about.
They don't realise you're
the
working.
The history of mankind. it's ridiculous.
So status is the next thing, but very, very early stages.
Yeah, I haven't even started
yet. Done anything.
Yeah, it's going to be out in 2021.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll see you then.
You could be dead by then, Will.
Yeah,
we've established this.
Yeah.
I love that confidence. I'll be out. I've been working on a book for 6 years. 6 years.
Mm. You have.
For 6 years, though.
What book is it?
It's a book. I think I mentioned it before, and obviously it didn't have much of an impact. Each chapter is a different TV show that I've worked on, and going into intricate detail of what an arsehole I was in some cases, what other...
I would read that in a second.
I know, but it turns out writing a book, Will, is really, really hard.
You need a ghostwriter, mate.
How much do you charge these days?
We'll talk about it off the air.
That laugh means he's expensive. All right. Well, it's always lovely to see you. Anytime you want to come in, traditionally guests come in at the top of the hour, but that's fine. The science of storytelling. I can't look at him, Catherine. Is he angry? Will Storr, STOR. If you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet a link to it. Amazon, is there a better place for you? Is there a place you get
more money?
Do
you know who support me?
Yeah.
Foils.
Foils.
They're very supportive of me.
We'll
find
the link for Foils then. Yeah. We'll do that. We'll send that out.
And they can send it out. They can post the book to you as
Brilliant.
Well.
I always prefer doing that if we can avoid it. The show continues 03444991000. This is Talk Radio.
Experience the unconventional.
Evening, boss.
The unpredictable.
What's happening?
And the completely unorthodox.
Exactly.
With rule-free Ian Lee. The late night alternative with Ian Lee.
I've got no internet for the last 4 days.
On Talk Radio.